You're listening to The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Traditionalist, but not with Matthew Heidmark today. You've got me, Sven Longshanks, once again, and it's the 27th of September 2016. I do have with me Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from the Traditionalist Worker Party. How are you doing today, Matt?
I really appreciate you having me on. Things are going not as miserable as I've been recently, so it's just an improvement.
Yeah. Well, I thought maybe we'd do a bit of a different episode today. I know everybody else is going to be talking about the debate last night, so I thought maybe we would do something a little bit different and maybe concentrate a little bit on your Orthodox Nationalist series, which I'm fascinated by them. I listened to some of them more than once, and some of the topics in there I find really, I think they could do with expanding on slightly, because a lot of the time I think when we look at these topics in history, we project our own concepts of what these words mean back into the past, as if the people in the past thought of these things in the same way as we do now. I think one of these topics particularly is homosexuality, which we look at now as if it's some kind of lifestyle and people are born that way. But I know that it really wasn't that way back then. And you did a really good podcast covering this in one part of it, where you were talking about the way that it was anti-natural, and it was all to do with black magic, which is the opposite of what we're taught today. And I just thought maybe we could start off by elaborating on that slightly, if you would.
Well, you know, E. Michael Jones has a new book out called Barren Metal, and that was what the very old name for usury. The idea being that homosexuality, on the one hand, and metal, really any matter, on the other hand, are not, they don't naturally reproduce themselves. And usury is to barren metal, you know, what homosexuality is to the human being. It's totally non, it doesn't reproduce. And to claim that it does is to lie. It's a completely unnatural connection. And that's the connection between alchemy and homosexuality.
So it's like the one thing that the homosexuals can't have is that they can't actually produce children. So that's the one thing that they're desperate to procure for themselves with this drive that they have now to call themselves married and try and get hold of these children. It's trying to create something for them that is completely unnatural and never could actually happen naturally. So it's the one thing that they most want, that sort of thing, do you think?
Yeah, this was one of the first issues in college. When I got started, it was a pro-life issue and the fags. This is what got me politically active. First of all, with the gays, it was so, I couldn't even think about it without getting completely grossed out for what they do. But there is an alchemical notion here that the sewer system of the human body receives it's very opposite. The life in terms of the human semen goes not where it's supposed to, but into the store system. It is the very essence of Satanism. But having children is what marriage exists for, primarily. That's not the only purpose, but it's a very important purpose. And because it's not a natural union, they can't have kids. So, but it wasn't that long ago. It wasn't maybe 10 years ago. The homosexual rights movement was condemning the family, condemning marriage. They called the heterosexual couples breeders. And then suddenly, from some source, the word came down, you have to now start pushing for marriage. So they went from 10 years ago condemning marriage to demanding it. And all it really meant was that the state allowed them to file taxes jointly. Gays have been getting married in America for many, many years. But the state had never recognized it in certain places. But the average American actually believed it was illegal for gays to be married in these states. All it really meant was that the state would not recognize that union financially and for tax purposes.
Well, it's effectively saying that because it's the Marriage Act, isn't it? That's the union of the man and the woman is the actual Marriage Act. They weren't handing out certificates saying that people were married years ago. So what they've actually done is redefine the act of creation into the act of anti-creation by doing that, by saying that there is a gay marriage. And you're saying that this goes back to alchemy. So there must be the most sort of wicked, most despicable act that they could possibly do, putting what should be there to create life in the sewer system.
Exactly. That, and that I've never come across a Satanist that didn't agree that the human semen is as powerful a creation of God. To treat it with the most disrespect humanly possible is demonism. What's the worst way you can show disrespect? It's putting it on top of, again, the sewer, on top of feces or the sewer system. That's precisely it. It's a total inversion. It's a mockery of God's creation.
And would this go back to the black magicians of the past then, and the Satanists? Would this have formed a part of their rituals, do you know?
I don't know that off the top of my head. I know Michael Hoffman, has made that argument in the past. I don't know of that. I know that there's been sex magic and sexual rituals in the past. I don't know if homosexuality has been a part of that, but it's gone. You know, it's very much a part of the older alchemical mentality for a very long time.
I know that Aleister Crowley was promoting that sort of thing, and you'd think that if this goes back to this sort of sex magic, that it was more a part of a satanic ritual than trying to put themselves on a par with a man and a woman. I don't think they've ever tried to say that it's an equivalent as a relationship between a man and a woman. I think it's they've always ridiculed and mocked the relationship between the man and the woman. I mean, even just going back 100 years, they would put on these mock marriages, and they would ridicule the fact that people married. And just 10 years ago, as you were saying, they would say that people that were married were breeders. So they've always mocked the heterosexual lifestyle, and yet today we're told that it's an equivalent of the heterosexual lifestyle, when it's always been a complete inversion of it, and has even formed a part of the black magic as well. Like the most despicable thing that they could possibly do to the human body, that's been what they were doing as part of a black magic ritual.
It's been a sudden shift, because I've been protesting against the gay rights for many, many years, and it's been all of a sudden they shifted from hating marriage and pouring contempt on it to and right away. Now, if you look at every gay rights, major gay rights movement in America, for example, look at their donations page, and it's a who's who of corporate America. So the most powerful people in American capitalism are backing this. So from one of these sponsors, the word came down that this has to happen. It was a very sudden shift, and I'm not sure what the mentality was here, but maybe it was just simply that they could destroy the institution much more quickly if a healthy marriage with children is put on the same par as these vile homosexual males.
Well, I think the fact that these homosexuals don't have a wife and children to bring up, if you think over a lifetime how much it costs to bring up a family, and these homosexuals aren't having to do that, so they must be able to amass a lot of money, I would have thought, as well. So, and once they get into a corporate position, i.e. a director or on the director's board, they're then going to be lobbying to get more homosexuals into that position. So I should imagine they're into very high powered positions with a lot of money and able to pay for all this lobbying. I know there's a large Jewish influence on this, but the homosexuals themselves must have be quite powerful. Just financially, they must be quite powerful, because they don't have to pay out the money that the rest of us have to pay out. And I think this has been a fear in the past as to why you could not allow them to flaunt it in the way that they do. You couldn't allow them into these positions, these boardroom positions. Hitler and Himmler, they both spoke about the fact that if you allowed homosexuals in there, that they would attract other homosexuals, and they work like a fifth column, like a state within a state, almost like a secret society that were helping out other members of the secret society. So I think this has played a large part of it, because now we see in our government that we see that a large portion of the people that make up the different parties in parliament are now homosexual, far more than the 1-2% that we are told it actually exists in the population. So we've got this big homosexual influence now that's in the halls of power, and this goes back to a satanic ritual, basically. That's what Satanism is. It's the adversary. It's turning things on its head, doing the opposite of what life is, and that's what this ritual is that they do. And it's part of black magic. So to then say that is the equivalent of the of the sexual act, the marriage union, has got to be the pretty much the ultimate in antichrist behavior, I would have thought. And yet our churches now are all saying, well, we should be allowing gay marriage. In the Church of England, they've now got gay bishops. They're talking about gay bishops in the Catholic Church. You've got Pope Francis saying that who is he to judge? And yet this act, this homosexual act, this is not a harmless act. This is the pretty much the ultimate satanic act that can actually be done. And this goes back right the way back to Old Testament times. Sodom, the city being destroyed for that. Now you say that there's a link with the bankers because of the fact that what they are doing with usury is making the money reproduce itself, which is unnatural because it can't reproduce itself. But do you know if these bankers have been involved in these homosexual acts right the way through history as well? Has this been something they've been involved in as well as usury?
Well, I think you're right to point out that Sodom and Gomorrah, you're not just talking about sexual license, whether it be homosexual or the destruction of marriage or whatever, but probably abortion and usury and homosexuality as well. I mean, human society is as much part of nature as anything else, and therefore there's a natural order. And one thing I think we could all agree on is unnatural is that money can't in and of itself make more money. So the connection between this desire of the bankers on the one hand and the homos on the other is very clear. It just underscores the unnaturalness about it. One point I wanted to bring out: it's often mentioned that the ancient Greeks practiced male homosexuality, and the evidence for this is very, very weak. People have tried to say that Socrates and Plato were homosexuals. And it really comes down to their rhapsodizing about the shape of certain male bodies, talking about their friends in terms that we would consider to be romantic. Unfortunately, because everything wasn't hypersexualized then, a man could talk about, even rhapsodize about, the beauty of the male form without even being remotely a homosexual. But if an American were to read this today, an Englishman were to read this today, they would say, oh my God, they're flaying Richard Simmons. Flamboyant. And it goes back to the central concept that these methods of speaking, these words, traditions, they don't mean the same thing. Even in translation, these words don't mean the same then as they do now. Society was not hypersexualized, and therefore it would be okay for a man to do that. Homosexuality wasn't practiced in ancient Greece or any more so than anywhere else. It's just that the rhetoric that they used to describe one another was very effusive, and they could, and with legitimacy, describe the beauty of the male form without having any erotic desire for it. But this comes up over and over again, that this was one great civilization that allowed homosexuality, and it didn't.
So you look at they look at Platonic love now and say that it must have been sexual love back then, because that's what they debase themselves with today. So that must have been the same back then, whereas we're talking about it quite innocently. I think you can tell that from the statues, because if okay, they have nude statues, but if they were supposed to be sexualized statues, they would have oversized genitals, and they don't. The Greeks would undersize the genitals as if to emphasize celibacy more than anything else. They weren't emphasizing sexual abandon. They were emphasizing sexual restraint by showing smaller genitals than you would normally expect to see, or from hiding the genitals. They were showing modesty. So I think that the statues themselves show this, that back in ancient Greece, ancient Athens, homosexuality was looked upon as badly as it was looked upon today, 20 years ago. And obviously because they brainwashed us all into changing our attitudes. So right. Instead of our natural instincts protecting us, we're taught to subdue those natural instincts and pretend that they're just the same as everything else. And this hideous act that they debase themselves with doesn't exist, because that's what it boils down to, is this act that they do. And back then, I think, and even today, with you get the Arabs, they claim that they're not homosexual, and yet they engage themselves in this act that they carry out, and yet they will say that they're not homosexual. There was recently an imam that called for an anal jihad, he called it. It was in the Daily Stormer. And he was saying that Muslims that are away from their wives, it's quite okay for them to indulge in anal sex if where they are is for the purposes of jihad. And jihad doesn't have to be violent. It can just be moving to another country and trying to replace the population, or trying to influence the schools. That's all forms of jihad. So he was saying if they're away from their wives, anal sex with other men is perfectly fine. And yet they would look at themselves as being heterosexual. This idea that homosexuality, people are born feeling these feelings for other men, is completely false. This is an idea that's just come about in the 20th century. Because it's occurred before out of desperation, like it does in prisons. And as it does with dogs, it occurs in a form of dominance and submission, forcing people to submit to your will. And again, it was used by the Arabs in this way, to force people to submit to their will. So we've got various things that this is used for. You've got the satanic act, like a magical ritual, and you've got a form of dominance over people, and yet we're looking back in time, looking back at the Greeks with the Platonic love, and projecting that onto it, and further beyond than that, we project it. I mean, the homosexuals try to say they try to bring up these characters from the past, and if they had like say King David had a friend who he was close to, and the homosexuals will try and say, well, he must have been homosexual because he was friends.
David and Jonathan, you're referring to, yeah.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And today, this really harms us, especially with the white nationalist movement as well, because you can't form these bonds with other men, because you'd be frightened that they might think you're homosexual if you form a strong brotherly bond. This is the harm that it does, isn't it?
The very fact that Athenian soldiers did their exercises naked, that Spartan soldiers did their exercises in the nude, something that the Persians, by the way, thought was outrageous, shows you there was no purient interest here. They had, well, you can't do this today. They had very intimate relationships with other men, intimate but not sexual, not erotic. You couldn't do that today. The way that they wrote each other, they spoke to each other. A homosexual activist will take this stuff, the way Plato talked, often actually, and say, my God, he was flaming, how blatant he was about it, and how he was just rhapsodizing about how certain boys would look. But it just shows you a completely non-historical understanding. The American context is total commercialized hypersexuality. Everything immediately has a sexual element. There's hardly a word in the English language that doesn't have a slang use that's sexual. But back then, it wasn't the case. You can have a statue. I mean, the phrase that the Supreme Court uses is purient interest. That's this erotic longing, sexual longing. But you can be intimate, you could be very, very close friends with a man in ancient Greece without even be lovers. Even using that word, we would translate in English, lovers, but that wouldn't be erotic. That would be people who are pursuing wisdom. I mean, philosophy means the love of wisdom. So Plato can call, he'd refer to as male lovers. But only in America would that be interpreted as a homosexual union. It's not.
Well, that's a good point that you bring up there. I mean, if you look at the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle and the life of Alfred the Great and things that were written around that time and the Chronicles of England, it talks about a love day, which was a peace day, meeting at peace. And it talks about kings being in love with other kings, which is when they've made peace with them. So the word love had a completely different meaning to it back then to what it has now, a totally different meaning. So if we look back on it and we read that, we would think, oh, this, it's homosexual acts it must be involved in. And I think this must go back to Freud, who said that everything had a sexual basis to it, because things obviously didn't have a sexual basis to it before then. People really didn't know that much about sex. And if you look back at pictures of women from 100 or so years back, that none of them were trying to look sexy. They all were wanting to look like your mother or your sister, and that was the way that they were treated. But since Freud, who said that everything must boil down to sex, it must boil down to a sexual attraction. The only reason why you would do anything for anyone is because there must be some kind of sexual attraction there. And this is really twisted and really warped, I think. But that's where I think it goes back to, is Sigmund Freud. Have you had any thoughts on that at all?
No, I think you're right. The word love, I mean, word love comes up in the New Testament. Christ says to love your enemies. And Americans today will read that and roll their eyes, not having any idea what that word meant a long time ago. It didn't mean erotic longing. It didn't mean just complete indulgence. It didn't even mean being nice to them. It was about being faithful to God's law. This is our perpetual eternal job. To love your enemies, it's to speak the truth to them. It is perfectly consistent with love in the true sense of the word to destroy a political movement, for example, like communism, that can destroy a society. We love these people, therefore we're going to destroy their movement and send them to prison for a while. That is perfectly consistent with love in the older sense of the word. But today, it's either sexual or something vaguely connected to indulgence. And this is how, and the word love is never translated. It's used all the time, but people never say what they mean. There was a very specific meaning that was used right up until really a few hundred years ago. In the Russian language, there is no distinction between the word like and the word love, which, by the way, if you've ever dated a Russian woman, it gets very awkward when they say, do you love me? This is autobiographical, by the way. Do you love me? And I say, well, no, not yet. And it didn't occur to me. She just asked me, do I like her? Because in the Slavic languages, love and like are the same word, lubit. And so I have scared away or insulted more than one Slavic woman in the past. But that just goes to show that there wasn't this connection. Love and like were the same word. The idea of a wife being this sexual object or romantic love having this saccharine element to it is very new. It's very 20th century. People did not marry based on looks or this emotional feeling like they were drunk with the endorphins flooding their brain like people do today. That wasn't the case. The family was the natural unit of society. It was economic. It was spiritual, but it was not sexual. Today, though, the hypersexuality has reached a point where we can't help but read these desires back into history. And so when Christ says, love your enemies, you think of some kind of indulgence like two people in love would give to each other. It's absolute nonsense. And it's destroying people.
So it just means keep to your word. Keep your word and be faithful to what you say. Be honorable. Be honorable to your enemies might be a better translation of it. I think today people mistake lust for love. And in the past, you would, as you say, you wouldn't be marrying for looks. They wouldn't be marrying because they've fallen in love. They would be marrying because it had been arranged. They would be marrying who their parents told them to marry. This is honor your mother and your father. You marry who your parents tell you to marry. And if you're lucky, after you've had children, when you're grandparents, then you might be in love. You would get the being in love at the other end of your life. You would live together with somebody, and if you're lucky, the love would grow. Whereas now it's the opposite way around, and people fall out of love just as quickly and as easily as they fall in love. And you end up with the unwanted children and the divorces and all the mess that brings, the indulging in Cupid. And in the past, I don't think people would have had so much chance for that to happen. Because the idea of dating or getting together with various different girls to find which one is the one that you want, that just wouldn't have happened. You would have had an arranged marriage. So every male would have known that he was going to have a woman that he would be married to. The idea of divorce would be quite out of the question. So they would have just had to get on with it and see how it turned out. And India, which is not even a white country, they had a very, very low divorce rate up until a couple of years ago when they started becoming infected with feminism. And all their marriages were arranged marriages. And I saw a documentary on the BBC, and they were interviewing these women about these arranged marriages, and they couldn't find any of them over the age of 40 that would say it was a bad thing. And all the ones that were in their 50s, they were the happiest people that you'd ever seen. You know, they'd had this arranged marriage, they'd gone through life, and they'd gradually fallen in love at the other end of the marriage. And that's what had brought them contentment. And there were no divorces. And yet we look at it the way that we do it. We just fall in lust with somebody. We think, whoa, we must be in love. I've never felt like this before, and we must get married. And it's all over within 6 months. There's this big rush of passion. And that's all it is a rush of passion. Whereas before, it used to be done the other way around. If you look in the Old Testament, it's arranged marriages. You know, Abraham, Isaac, all of them, they're very careful about who their descendants are going to marry. They arrange it for them. There's none of this, well, we'll just meet up with somebody and pick who we want. It was the parents that picked them for them. And I think this shows that the importance that was placed on ethnicity back then and on the blood. They knew that you had to keep within the race, keep within the ethnicity, how damaging and dangerous it would be to outbreed from the ethnicity. But we're wandering off the topic here slightly.
Even words like you mentioned, family, parents, you know, the word family today did not mean the same thing as it meant 200 years ago and beyond. The family meant the extended, what we would call the extended family. We're talking about, or even a clan, a large number of people. The nuclear family, as the name suggests, is very, very recent. The nuclear family is not a natural unit. Actually, it's the extended family, all living within the same area. And then they would have matchmakers to go from village to village and would set up these marriages. If marriages were not based on this, you know, almost drug-like trance that men get in when they get into somebody, which causes more pain, as we all know, than pleasure. So it's completely irrational and shouldn't be done, even though we can't resist it when it happens. The ancients, of course, knew this. And when the marriage is not based on that, and no one had any expectation that it should be based on that, they didn't have any problem with this. There was nothing wrong with this. Only, I guess, 19th century, and even there, only in the upper classes did you get the idea that this trance-like love state, which leads to so much pain, is a ground of the most natural institution in the world, of the family and the production of children. It's ridiculous. So you have the nuclear family, and a marriage based on that kind of romantic sexual love is false, it's new, and it's just as destructive as anything else.
Well, I think this passing around from one partner to another, I think that can be traced back to, you know, homosexuality as well, because the heterosexual state of things is for one man to have one woman and to produce children. And that's the traditional setup, basically, that there's been the same for centuries. And then you've got homosexuals who pride themselves on having the maximum amount of partners possible, on having hundreds of different partners, sometimes in one night having more than one partner. And now we end up with our young men thinking that it's manly to sleep around, to sleep with as many women as possible, whereas that's not actually the heterosexual lifestyle. That's the modern homosexual lifestyle, is to sleep around with as many different partners as possible.
Exactly.
So it's infected heterosexuality as well, hasn't it?
Well, the sexual revolution is a product of the late 60s, product of the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Kinsey Institute in Indiana, etc. It came from big money, and the purpose ultimately was to individualize people, to isolate people one from another. The traditional family was gone. The nuclear family had taken its place. Then they went to that final last step. Right now, the American male, their self-esteem is tied up in if what women like them or not, if women find them attractive or not. And it could destroy a man if he's rejected by this. This is the problem. Basing things on this trance-like love is so ridiculous, because if it's not reciprocated, or if they meet somebody else, or you fall out of it, the pain that's caused is unspeakable. That can't possibly be the foundation of, if, you know, society is based on the family. That can't be the basis of society then. And that's, you know, everything about this is wrong. And yes, it is the homosexual lifestyle, because right now, for young people, having a baby is the worst thing that could possibly happen to them. And they go to great lengths, but you couldn't have that, prior to the 1960s. You couldn't have, that kind of activity, because you didn't have birth control and you didn't have legal abortion. So there is no way that you had this kind of sexualization of people prior to the late 1960s. It was physically impossible. Though I know sexual revolutionaries will say that there's no doubt that prior to, people were always like this. People were always having sex whenever they could. And it's just not true. It couldn't have happened without birth control, without abortion. Now, especially a man, young men have their entire self-esteem and self-worth and self-image tied up into whether or not attractive women like them. And that creates matriarchy, gynocracy, and it's where we are today. It's a complete, absolute disaster.
That's incredibly damaging to our young men as well. They can be completely crushed when they get let down. And instead of wanting to be good to the people around them, they end up resenting the people around them or withdrawing within themselves. It is something that really needs to be looked at. And I don't think the men's rights movement is really doing much to look into that side of things. They seem more interested in still promoting the sleeping with as many women as possible, sort of the game idea. At least in white nationalism, there is a bit of a push against that and a push back towards traditionalism. Well, Matt, thank you very much for coming on once again. Thank you, listeners, for listening. I should be back tomorrow with Matt Parrott, I think, and hopefully we'll have Matthew Heimbach back near the end of the week. So thanks for listening. Tune again tomorrow and hail victory.
You've been tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArea.com.